Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hello and welcome to Minto Dialogue, episode number 238. Today is Sunday, the 4th of June, 2017, and this interview is with Tiffany St. James, digital transformation strategist and renowned international speaker. Tiffany is the former head of public participation for the UK government and an executive director at the British Interactive Media Association. In this podcast, we discuss with Tiffany the best ways to accelerate digital transformation, how to create entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs, and fulfilling impact versus creating legacy. Welcome to the Minto Dialogue Internet Show, where we discuss brand marketing with a focus on all things digital. I am Minto Dial, author of themindset.com, that's T-H-E-M-Y-N-D-S-E-T, where branding gets personal. You'll find the show notes on the blog for the upcoming interview. Let's cut to the quick. Enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to the Minto Dialogue. Today with me, Tiffany St. James. Tiffany and I have spoken at a number of conferences, run into you all over the place, love what you're up to, and of course, we share certain very similar ideas. So Tiffany, tell us who you are in your words, and what's your mindset? Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Minto. I'm delighted to be on your show today. My name is Tiffany St. James. I'm a digital transformation strategist, and I guess I really cut my teeth in a decade of digital transformation in the UK government. I was fortunate enough to join in a period of, I think, the most transition any large institution has ever seen of that size and nature. I joined when we pre-email and left just after open data. So saw enormous changes within that period of time. So the work that I now do through Transmute, my consultancy, is to help large businesses, other governments around the world, embed better digital and social media capability, if you like. So that's a little bit of who I am and what I've been up to. And really my mindset, almost every task that I had within the UK government had never been done before. So my mindset is do it till you're told not to. hung for a sheep is a lamb, I guess they might say. charge on ahead. You need to be able to get things done.
My goodness. Well, one has to imagine that the world of government and the world of business is radically different. How would you describe the differences of charging through digital transformation in a government environment versus a business?
Well, it's quite interesting. I guess if you're outside of government, people have certain kind of set stereotypical views of what government might be like. So people generally in faster moving industries, in technology, advertising, marketing, kind of look at government as a bigger, slower beast. But actually, in the period that I worked there, we were doing some really groundbreaking, innovative pieces of work that had the eyes on the world, at least from other governments, looking at the UK to see what we were doing and how we were doing it and how they might be able to learn from us. So I guess the first thing is that I see more similarities than differences in working in large businesses, global HQs. I mean, my role as a head of profession for social media for the cabinet office joining up, so say 32 central government departments, is the same as going to a global HQ and joining up 20 countries. It's actually, you know, you might have doctrine come down from the top, but it's actually middle management and people and policy and process that enables change programs to really embed. So So I didn't see that many differences, if you like.
Well, so then if we stick with the similarities, as you said, there are the different connections that need to be made between the different business units, or maybe departments, if you're talking between HR and you know, IT or whatever. But another way to describe it might be filled with molasses and bureaucracy.
You're absolutely right, but you will find that in as many large organisations as you do government. Any large institution is kind of driven by the layers and layers of people management. It's very hard to have a flat structure or a flatter structure in larger organisations. And, you know, many forward-thinking organisations are trying to flatten those structures for, as you very rightly say, the molasses, if you like, and the slower moving way in which communication and programs and ideas can travel in the business, certainly.
All right, so let's look at digital transformation. And in the end of the day, going again, I like the idea of sort of looking at the difference between the way it works in government and the way it works in business. Because when we have digital transformation, we can be talking about communication in general. We can be talking about the innovation process. We can be talking about the internal methodologies and how to better improve research and development, speed of response time, I don't know, dealing with crises. How do you break down driving digital transformation when it could potentially cover everything?
Absolutely, and it's a very key question, and people mean many different things by it. So the first thing to determine is, I look at it as, is it a technical infrastructure project? And many people talk about digital transformation. What they really mean is the back-end plumbing and the wiring, if you like. So first to determine it, is it technology? And then aside from that, I break it down into people, processes and technology, because many people, when they talk about digital transformation, in fact, just mean digital marketing transformation and how they're going to enable better, I don't know, customer-centric delivery, for example. So the first thing that you really need to determine is digging down into the scope of the project and what are the elements that it touches. And I think those can easily be enabled in people, process and technology.
So if you had advice to somebody who's saying, gosh, I really want to accelerate my digital transformation process, we've been doing it for 2 years, the boss keeps on hammering at the table, or is the boss, by the way, who's hammering on the table, well, I want more digital transformation, I want quicker. What kind of advice would you provide for them?
Well, absolutely. I mean, A, if it's been running for 2 years and they still want sort of quicker results, then they really need some help. but the second thing is, what do they want to see, and what do they want to have been enabled differently as the result of a program or piece of work over a specific time? So what are the actual outcomes that they're looking for? Is it that they're going to pick, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 services that they deliver and just make the process much more elegant? So there's a very, very streamlined digital sales process, for example. Or is it that they're actually embarking on a digital literacy program and they need to ensure that all of the people within the business have better skills within digital? Or is it actually that they're trying to do a very specific technical innovation where moving from print to digital, for example, it's really, really the first thing is framing that scope of work.
It strikes me as we look at a lot of these projects you and I are working on, that they might come in with a very different business challenge. For example, I want to accelerate my innovation cycle. For example, I want to make my sales team more productive. For example, I want to cut costs. And each comes with their own need and their own different culture and background and baggage and stuff. What also strikes me is that it seems to always lead back down to the same things, which include the boss needs to model the example, we need to be more customer-centric. Do you find the same things, and what would you add to that list, or how would you answer my thought there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's looking at very specific problems. Yes, there are some elements that you might always look at, particularly in sort of the first approach, clarifying objectives and undertaking an audit of the digital current delivery, if it's a digital change program, for example. But some of the things you mentioned, how do I make my sales team more productive? how are they measuring productivity to start with of their sales team? And that's very unique to actually, I want to cut costs. Again, how are they measuring the current, you know, cost attribution of a particular product or service? It might be entirely different from how they measure the productivity of a sales, but it's going to start with that measurable metric base. If you're putting in a program of activity, you absolutely need to define clear objectives and break that down very singularly. But then you have to look at how is that currently being measured. Much of the work that I do when I'm brought in initially is actually to help the C-suite clarify the objectives and clarify the program, because they're finding it very hard to specify exactly what they're trying to look at themselves in the first instance.
Lovely answer, Tiffany. What about data? So let's say that there's a term out there and it's sort of on everyone's mouths, but to what extent do you find governments and or big businesses managing data, and what kind of advice do you have about trying to figure out to use that swamp of a word?
Yes, I mean, we could spend an entire podcast just on data. It's one of my favourites. I had the great pleasure to work on the launch of the data.gov.uk, the government's first open data platform, if you like, and was given Sir Tim Berners-Lee as part of my project team to help establish the UK government as the most transparent in the world, which it is now independently accredited as being, and a huge, huge interest of mine, if you like. So in terms of the UK government, we had to launch the open data store in something very significantly fast. We were given the ACE team, let's face it, to be able to help with that program of work. But we had 8 weeks, and we had 8 weeks to be able to do and deliver it to it, as you know, some political deadlines are. And essentially, the very first thing that we needed to do is be able to make sure that the data was in the same format. So there was a lot of kind of background tagging program to make sure that we could build something with the data when it was pulled together. We had to come up for the very first time with kind of data flushing processes to be able to get data out of departments. And then we had to, you know, be able to put it all in one place in a way in which that, you know, developers, coders and programmers could use it and make useful things with it. So that was an approach, if you like, to look at, actually, let's get the data in the same state. Let's ensure that it's stored all in one place. Let's tag it effectively, that so we can, with linked data, build appropriate useful resources with it and keep that open so the UK public could review that at any time, but also to nail that data flushing process. Now, since data.gov.uk was launched, there was a great interest amongst our team in looking at other government data stores that came out afterwards. And actually, it was interesting to see what came after us and if we could learn those lessons and what we might be able to do again. And of course, everyone's building on each other's work and standing on the shoulders of giants. And it was really interesting to see what came out of Estonia, because they've got a much smaller government. They're much smaller, you know, policy areas, much smaller number of kind of pages, but they just published the code on every page. And actually, that was a very, very elegant way of being able to create their data store very simply and very quickly. So there's many different ways in which that organizations can start to, you know, approach data projects. It's all going to come down, what is that for? What are they going to do with it as a result of doing that, and being very, very clear on those objectives. But those processes of making sure it's in the same state, making sure it's available in one place, making sure the data can talk to each other and be built upon, are kind of the good ground principles, if you like. You need a couple of different types of data to make anything useful. So you need historic data, you need planning data and forward-looking data, you need real-time data, and then you need data delivered geographically and geolocated to build useful services.
And is predictive data also something that we should be talking about?
Yeah, so in that future data, the forward-looking data, I include predictive data.
Uh-huh. So one of the things I'm thinking about, Tiffany, as we speak, is this notion of transparency. So when we're talking open, we obviously are going to be talking about transparency. And yet, you can't or don't want to necessarily expose everything. So, for example, you might have material that is confidential. You might have you know, your Secret Service material. So there's obviously some areas that a government has that they don't want to have open. Just focusing on that particular angle with regard to open, data.gov.uk, how did you decide where the line was between what you will allow open and what should be remain under the under lock and key?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a decision sort of, further up in government, if you like, in terms of that drive. Because if it was public sector data, then there was a program that it had to be open. It had to be open so that everything from, I don't know, salaries of expenses, what was spent within government departments. I mean, obviously, there's a huge program of work to be able to flush that out in the first place. So essentially, there is some data. There is some data that is private because it's sensitive or it's not within the realms of public use or public knowledge. We've had within the government context for very many years the freedom of information request. So if a potential individual feels that it is in a public benefit and use, they can ask government directly for that data. And there's teams of people in every government department to be able to answer those requests. But there are some things then, if they're a matter of public sensitivity or civic contingency, that fall outside of that.
Well, it's a tricky topic because on top of that, the crossover for government is when they go see our friends at Google or Twitter saying, we want your data too.
Sorry, who's the we in that?
That would be the government.
Yes, okay.
So, listen, you have some tweets that we'd like to, or, you know, not some tweets, but some SMSs or whatever that we'd like to uncover.
Yeah, and essentially, I mean, government have got the authority and opportunity to put whatever rules and parameters they have around their data. I can't speak of the current government having left as a consultant a few years ago now in terms of what they're asking of other large departments. So. It was interesting in the early days of social media to actually sit down and work out what our strategies might be with the huge providers. We had the great opportunity to be visited by the head of communications at Facebook to look at actually should we be having, you know, Facebook pages from government departments and how that might work, how we might be able to work and interact together. So I think it's always actually really, really important that government and large businesses essentially make better relationships with platform providers to enable them to have those kind of discussions.
But isn't at the heart of that trust?
But I mean, people have different levels of trust, don't they? They have different versions of trust between one and each other and in business context. So. What I think is super interesting is how trust has changed and how the world is much more transparent as an advent of transparency initiatives such as the UK government, as well as the kind of forcing of social media and the personal point of view of individuals to bear down on accountability of organisations. And we've seen that change. I think Edelman do a brilliant tracking barometer every year, the Edelman Trust Barometer. And the top three kind of trusted individuals in a corporate context were always an academic or a specialist. And essentially, a person like yourself was always third. And that levelled out last year, that a person like yourself is as trusted as an academic and specialist. And of course, you know, that makes a huge effect on how corporations are considering in their communication strategies to engage with, you know, influencers in the public domain, for example.
Going back to another topic, which is a driving innovation, driving agility, and part of the digital transformation process, let's say in a big business, one of the terms we like to say, well, we need to be more entrepreneurial. And so if you're in a big business and I tell you to run a startup in my big business, well, they usually roll the eyes. But we use this word being an entrepreneur. And you know, some people join big companies or join the government because they're not interested in that sort of chaotic life of being an entrepreneur. They like the stability. They like the idea of job for life. But how do you create or encourage more entrepreneurs within the organization?
It's a fascinating subject, and it's been a pleasure to be a part of my work, really, because what we've noticed in all of the digital transformation processes and programs that I've worked, had the pleasure to kind of work on and run over the last decade or so, is actually the people enablement of enabling those programs to happen. You can have all the great processes and all the great technology, but actually kind of motivating people to be able to take those programs forward is the success of most programs. But actually, you get certain type of people, don't you, who are more intrapreneurial, if you like. They like working in large organizations and being able to help navigate that space and help make change and impact within a large business and organization, and kind of spotting those individuals, nurturing those individuals, or creating programs to enable people to contribute is hugely satisfying, but hugely, hugely effective. I mean, most organizations, if you look at a learning engagement program, will start at the very kind of simple lunch and learns. You know, it's open and people turn up to it. And actually, when you start to map then perhaps internal kind of training and learning against people's job description, you're going to get more benefit from that. But where it becomes really interesting is the entrepreneurial programs, whether that's building corporate university and allowing people that kind of push and pull learning, or actually challenging them, all of the workforce, or a small part of the workforce, and take them through a program through looking at, hey, we would love you, just give them permission. We absolutely want your ideas. And giving them a process of enabling them to test those ideas and drive those programs are where we've seen, you know, dramatic change in organizations allowing individuals to do that.
All right, well, so here's where pushback comes. All right, but you can't do that at my place because I don't have any money. Second of all, I'm still using BlackBerry and my internet's crap.
Okay, so I had the great pleasure to work with the National Trust and helping them with the digital and social media. And some of the castles, some of the car parks, some of the beaches, they don't have Wi-Fi, right?
Yeah,
they don't have really good broadband even sometimes to be able to, you know, transfer digital communication. So with no budget, with no money, with old technology, one of the castles has a cauldron in the fireplace in reception that people write down ideas and put into the cauldron. So that to me, I absolutely love, because that is innovation, you know, with its sleeves rolled up, really. This isn't about money. This isn't about shiny technology to enable those ideas to happen. They wanted everyone from a ranger to a shepherd to a visitor center manager to be able to contribute to new ideas. And that was the common facility of which they could all do it. So you just need to be creative. You don't need a big budget.
It's not about the tech. It's about the mindset. So what about the notion of the leader? So the leader of the business, CEO, has to respond to shareholders, is also responsible for delivering profitability, top-line growth, hiring and firing, trade union negotiations, factory removals and ups and downs. And then there's this thing called digital transformation and all of that. To what extent or how does a CEO lead the digital transformation process? Is it something that can be delegated, or must it be led by him or her?
So I find digital transformation led by different people with C in the title. So it can come from finance, it can come from CFO, can come from a great COO. You want your leaders to absolutely champion the program, and almost every successful program we've seen is because of the leadership of that particular program. But we have also seen people lead from the middle of the pack, and that might be that the CEO isn't perhaps most the digitally enabled or the greatest digital vision, but to borrow your phrase, it's about the mindset, really. They don't necessarily need to know how to drive the business forward digitally, but they must allow it to happen, or champion that particular program to let people know it's permissible, that they have the support to drive those innovation and change programs through. And we've seen many organizations take a program forward with people with bright ideas in the middle saying, hey, we think we're going to change the business in this particular way. And it's allowing people not to have a kind of reporting bottom line to it. So they have the opportunity to experiment, and they have the opportunity to fail, really, to be able to try new things and innovate. And it's the leaders allowing and championing the ability to be able to do that, not just leading the program, which also creates success.
So without citing anyone, it makes me think, you know, you can give this job, per se, to a middle manager or someone else on the executive suite. The challenge is transforming that individual or enabling that individual actually to be the transformer. And the issue could be in the character of that person. So, for example, the boss, it's the boss's son in certain companies, which I know. It could be the most geeky person. It could be someone who is a consultant who comes from another organization. So they have different backgrounds. But the challenge is how do they then imbue and transform everybody else and pull along? Because nobody has the full set of equipment in their basket.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about setting up there's referred to sometimes as hubs or centers of excellence. So finding and defining your peer group across the organization that can enable that change, whatever that program of activity might be, to be able to ensure that the relevant departments or parts of the organization that you need to work with are part of the collaborative endeavor. So they're bought into the process, they're the right people who can enable things to happen, they can make decisions, they're the people with either the bright ideas or the opportunities to take those messages forward. And it's creating that network of internal advocates around that program that I think makes programs sometimes very successful.
I was going to take an example of somebody like Tim Berners-Lee. An amazing guy, knows a ton of stuff. Is he the kind of person you would have as your advocate? Because, you know, just an example, I don't know how he is. You can tell us how wonderful a man he is. But, you know, identifying that person, just because they may know a lot, they may not be the right conduit because of the lack of business sense.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you take the Open Data program. He's a lovely man, by the way.
I imagine as much. Never met him.
Very, very, very affable, brilliant academic, and very friendly guy, and very, very excitable in things that interest him, particularly around data. It was an absolute pleasure to work with him. But essentially, yes, you have, you know, a leader who has all the ideas and the knowledge, and how does that manifest in a business? Well, there's a small kind of production team, which was, you know, I think there was about five of us working on open data in the UK government. And then actually we had to find the people with the data in different departments. So then you create a role, if you like, not as someone's kind of paid job title, but actually we're going to make you responsible for data flushing within your department. And when we mean government department, it's the Department for Work and Pensions, or the Department for Health, or, you know, the Department for Transport. I mean, they're large, super large entities in their own right, rather than in businesses you'd have, perhaps have HR and compliance and sales and such like as departments maybe. And essentially, you know, some of those people were analysts, some of those people actually, you know, sat within a digital field, some of them were statisticians, but actually creating that, okay, your responsibility is for data flushing. And it's that network effect. So you've got one guy who has the big program and all the big ideas. You've got a small kind of production team that have the authority and responsibility to enable it to happen. And then your conduits who have the access to that information to be able to kind of create that information flow, really.
Must have been a very important part of that program, the communication. So in other words, if Tiffany St. James, who the hell is she, knocks on my door saying, I need your data, and the individual behind the door says, bugger off, how give us an idea of how the communication went down to enable that.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So the previous project that I had to data.gov, where this was also an issue, was I was the first communications director of DirectGov, so the precursor to gov.uk. So it was the government's, it was in fact at the time, and probably since, the world's largest web rationalization program, because we tore down 95% of government's websites over 5 years and repurposed that content or made a lot of it obsolete on one government website, DirectGov at the time, in one tone of voice. And actually at the time, it was part of my responsibility to engage with departments and get their information, not necessarily the data at that point, but their information on this site, with no long-term budget, no long-term strategy, no mandate that this had to happen. And, oh, by the way, your team will downsize significantly as a result of this program and you'll lose half your people. Can you imagine what an interesting sell that is?
Oh, yeah, right? Love that one.
And that's been a large part of my work, and it's stakeholder engagement at its highest touch point, because people are protective of their areas. They're protective of the information, people they hold, and the budget. Be proud of that. So you have to look at people's personal and political agenda. You have to get it mandated from on high as much as you possibly can. But in some instances, we've had things in the government mandated by the Prime Minister, and then government departments would say, oh yes, but you know, we're an exception, you understand. No, that's not how it is done here. So you have to look at some of the work that I did. Well, how do you influence, you know, a senior leader? And you have to look at, who are they influenced by, and how perhaps do you get the right information to the right people's hands so that they can be aware, because it doesn't come up from a grassroots way in all times. I mean, some of the work that I did was go and have dinner with entrepreneurs and tell them about the great work we've been doing in government, and it came back in, you know, to ministers sometimes in that way. Who are they influenced by, and how on earth can you have an opportunity to change their mind? And well, what is their fear factor? Is it a reputational issue? They don't want to lose a particular part of their work, their work remit, their budget. Is it they don't understand the program and therefore, you know, they need some knowledge to be able to make those decisions? Is it they don't agree with the program and therefore you have to look at, you know, putting the pros and cons in such a way that you can help enable them to, you know, come along with you on that program? I mean, there's many, many different ways at this, and it's one of the tougher things to be able to do in a transformation program is influencing leadership to enable that program to happen.
Well, it's what you say, I love it, because it makes me think, well, on the one hand, you could play the negative approach, fear factors, what's stopping you? But I feel oftentimes that what's stopping them is actually they don't know where they want to go. And so they don't want to go, but they don't know where they don't want to go. So it's back to your point, I say maybe it's about helping them formulate their strategy in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's trying to understand people, isn't it, really? What makes them tick? And it's trying to be able to read between kind of personal and political agenda with a small p. I'm not talking politics as of UK government. It's not the side of the work that I was working on. But even in large businesses, you know, perhaps they need to be made to look brilliant, you know, to their peers or to their direct report or the people that they're reporting to. And it's working out how you can help them with their known knowns and unknown knowns, if you like, in terms of that, to be able to explain things and break things down in such a way that they can make better choices and decisions and understand your program of activity, but where it fits their agenda.
Last part of that, maybe, is just this notion of creating a legacy. In the realm of knowing where you want to go and knowing what is your strategy, it occurs to me, Tiffany, that we might be in this most extraordinary of periods where we have finally at our disposal an extraordinary set of new tools, platforms, and devices, even if it's not about processes and technologies, but that are going to facilitate the creation of tremendous new legacies. The issue is, or maybe the question is that something that speaks to everybody? Or is it too grandiose an idea and only for the elite or silly intellectual few?
I don't think it's a question of elite or silly intellectual few, but I certainly don't think legacy appeals to everyone. There are people who actually only get out of bed to create impact, and have navigated, you know, interesting and unique and unusual career paths because they're chasing change and they're chasing impact. There are people, you know, who have one singular dream in terms of what they want to do and deliver, and they want to change the world in a particular fashion. And there are many people who this agenda doesn't cross their horizon in terms of just getting everything together, whether it's running their family or running their work or, you know, attending to their hobbies and interests. That I don't think everyone thinks about legacy.
Sort of like you can play a rugby match or a game and you play 80 minutes, you win, you lose. That's impact. The other one is build a museum that lasts for 100 years. You know, and some people get their rocks off of great team, great performance, some flair, great pass, and win on a rugby field. And others get their rocks off by having their name on a museum.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's really interesting in the digital context, though, because I was kind of clearing out the other day and looking at my own kind of portfolio, and almost everything that I've worked on is really hard to point to because it's superseded by the next digital innovation. So the work that might have gone in the past and the work that I'm proud of delivering, then essentially you can't point to it anymore. But luckily I've worked on some great programs, I think, that people remember because of the impact I had on their life at the time. So people being able to get the Cartax, you know, online was, you know, one of the great innovations that people go, oh, you were part of that program. That was great. That was so helpful, and still maintains, even if the site itself doesn't exist anymore.
Again, something that sunsetted. So, Tiffany, thanks so much for coming on the show. Time is of the essence. How can people follow you, track you down, get in touch with you? What would you prefer?
I am Tiffany St. James on most social channels. Most of my interaction with people is on Twitter, so Tiffany St. James on Twitter, and please do always kind of wave at me on LinkedIn too.
All right, I'll put also your site in the show notes. Thanks for coming on the line, and see you soon, Tiffany.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Minto. Bye bye.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minto Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes on themindset.com. That's mindset with a Y, where you can also sign up for my weekly newsletter at /subscribe. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes. That really makes my day. Happy trails, and enjoy Josh Sachs's Painted Fingers.
Oh, fill me with all your colors any different way to rid me of the gray and heal me with all your imperfections that you mention. Lack of self-security, oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm, wrapped in canvas, hold me tightly, slowly we would paint a lover's portrait with all your favorite shades, and we'd paint blend and look ugly in the end, but they're pretty in their own disgusting values. We'd hang our portraits in the hallways, make our house guests cringe. Oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm seeing all your colors. Show the with all your favorite shades, and we paint it with our fingers to show the world the way we feel. Oh, oh, the way I feel. Oh, the way I feel.
The Jim Stroud Podcast explores the discoveries and trends forming the future of our lives. Brain-to-brain communication, robot bosses, microchip implants for workers, and artificial intelligence replacing human workers are all happening now. If you want to know what's happening next, subscribe now to the Jim Stroud Podcast.